You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com, bringing you the freshest radio in Brooklyn since 2009. Hear directly from chefs to farmers, artists to architects, authors to brewers, and everyone in between. Check out all of our shows on our website or by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store.
All right, here we are. It's Sunday, which means it's the main course. I think it also might mean it's Meet the Press, but it definitely means it's the main course. We're going to start off with the Week in Review, and then we're going to have Terrence Brennan in. He's in studio with his harem of beautiful women. And then we have Aaron Fairbanks, who's going to talk about Goat-tober. But I got to start off the week in Review. Jack, congratulations. Hey. Carolyn Young was a really fundamental supporter of slow food in its early years. She wrote for the San Jose Mercury News, and I heard she tweeted your Daily Bites.
She did, and Todd sent me an email, said that she tweeted it out, which is good because more and more people are listening now.
No, I mean, that Daily Bite is pretty awesome. What was Friday's Daily Bite? Like pumpkin seeds or something like that?
That was Thursday was the pumpkin seeds, and Friday we were promoting the Occupy Big Food rally that happened yesterday, actually.
Well, let's talk about that. So, I mean, I went to Occupy Wall Street last Sunday, two Sundays before, last Sunday, I should say, and I was like emotional. I mean, I love that, you know, Obama, poor guy, cannot stand up to Goldman Sachs. And yet somehow, through in the rain and in the snow, these kids are. They are literally standing up to them. So you went. What did you think?
I went. And for the food part of it, you know, there were maybe 20 people there. And then the rest of the occupiers, I guess, were all in tents with generators. It was a really kind of almost sad but inspiring scene because they all stayed, you know, and they were intense and very intense, very powerful.
Well, let's play your 2-minute clip. Now, this two-minute clip has Anna Lappe, who writes a lot, and then there's Marion Nessel, who started the food studies program at NYU. So who was there exactly, Jack?
The Brooklyn Food Coalition was there. The director of American Meat was there. And a few other foodies, but here's a clip of...
This was a food rally, right, Jack?
Okay. And it was supposed to be bigger, but obviously the snow and the sleet really made things difficult, so... But anyway, here's a clip.
Cut to the videotape.
Hi, everyone. My name is Anna Lappe, and I'm so excited to be here, to be among all of us in support and with the people over at Occupy Wall Street. You know, I think we all can agree that our food system's pretty broken for the 99%, and it's working pretty well for the 1%. The CEO of Kraft Foods last year made 600 times more than the typical food prep worker who makes $9.18 an hour. So that's like the Kraft CEO is making something like $6,500 an hour. So we've got incredible inequality. We've got the same problems of, you know, deregulation and the commodities markets that made a windfall for the bankers and left tens of millions of people hungry. And, you know, I think that like the folks across the street, you know, things have to change, and it's not going to change just by us sitting around inside in our warm apartments. We have to come out into the streets sometimes. So thanks for being here, everyone.
And I'm Marion Nessel. I'm a professor at NYU, and I'm here in support of our wonderful students who've organized this. I was an undergraduate at Berkeley in the 60s, and I thought it would never come again, and I'm really happy to see it. So go for it, everyone.
I'm Mal. I'm a retired professor of nutrition from Cornell, upstate, and I'm a farm boy from Illinois, and I'm here to support you all.
I organized the event. I'm an NYU student. I'm here. I brought you all here. I'm sorry. Our food system is totally rotten. We need to fix it. We're going to keep doing these events. This is only the beginning, and I want you all to continue the momentum with me. The food movement needs to line up with Occupy Wall Street. We are inherently anti-corporate, and we're ready to fight.
There you go.
Wow, Jack, that is really, really intense. And I mean, it's funny, when I went down with Van, we saw this guy who had a sign for promoting a maximum wage. You know, and it wasn't saying that the hourly guy should be paid, you know, $40 an hour, but it was basically saying that you can't be paid $6,000 an hour.
Right, exactly.
That is just totally unnecessary. And what you're bringing to the table is not worth it. You know, it's not worth all that. That kind of maximum wage thing. I mean, this is something I said. I know it might be too hardcore, but I think it is morally unacceptable to work for Goldman Sachs. I'm talking above, like, the, you know, diner lady or the cleaner or whatever. I think basically it is deeply unacceptable, and like you have to hide that from your kids practically, that you work for Goldman Sachs, because they're doing some unacceptable things. But Jack, this network is actually very closely aligned with Occupy Wall Street. I mean, Flash Cash.
Well, yeah, first of all, I mean, the media scoffed at Occupy Wall Street in the beginning, you know? Yeah. It was just a silly, tiny thing. It was insignificant. But we were reporting on it, you know, the first few days, because Joanne Fleming, the host of Flash Cash, has actually now become the accountant for Occupy Wall Street.
And that must be a tough job, because they're getting money in like weird ways.
$500,000 in their account right now.
Yeah, exactly. They're getting a lot of donations. How does that get managed? Who's the true leader? I mean, who knows? It might be Joanne, you know, because I mean, she's the one dealing with all the money.
Could be us. I don't know.
Yeah, it could be us. We are Occupy Wall
That's
Street.
Right.
But we, of course, at Heritage, Heritage Foods USA, you know, which is kind of like an Occupy Thanksgiving, an Occupy Your Daily Pork Intake business, but also Heritage Radio Network. You know, we've been a real voice. I mean, there have been a lot of people that have come on and talked about Occupy Wall Street. Like, didn't Ann Saxelby, the number one cheesemonger in America, not the one who started it all, that person will be on later.
The number one woman in the world.
A woman, yes, a woman. The number one female cheesemonger in the world. Didn't she have a really kind of poignant...
Yeah, she synthesized it pretty well. Let me pull up a clip.
Yeah, go to the video.
Instead of having many small regional banks or many small regional processing facilities for milk, there are increasingly less and less options. And with less options, you get less sovereignty over your end product, and you also get less transparency when it comes to pricing and issues like that.
Yeah, and that was on our Daily Bite on Friday.
Yeah, that was, you know, really intense. So, I mean, I was thinking about, we concentrate on food. That's obviously what we do. So, you know, subsidies for small farms, that's been a kind of recurring theme throughout mm-hmm. the years on the network. I mean, this whole ethanol thing, all the farmers we work with are on the brink of being put out of business, even with us, you know, paying a very high price, you know, for the products that we buy.
Sure.
And that's because of this whole ethanol thing. I mean, that article you sent me from Mother Jones, mm-hmm. I mean, there is a direct correlation between some of these futures trading, you know, this whole Goldman Sachs invention where you bet on futures.
And the lives of farmers, yeah.
Exactly. And the lives of farmers, but also like the lives of human beings in places like Africa and all that. I mean, this is really direct connections, and it might be difficult to admit that there's a direct connection, but we should start calling it like it is. But, Jack, I know you were moved by the McRib sandwich. What was the story on that?
You know, it's just you go on CNN and the McRib returning is a national news story. And that just blows my mind. But not only is it, you know, it's McDonald's, whatever. This is something that comes back on the menu magically once a year. How is this a national news story? You have to just think someone's being paid, or, you know, it just doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, well, I mean, the whole commodity thing is, you know, commodity pricing, which is what farmers get paid, is
dictated
by farmers. I
just, you know, one more thing quickly. My 13-year-old brother, I see him on Facebook, and his Facebook status says, "The McRib is back." As if he's excited. And he's so young, you know, he wasn't even born when the McRib was introduced. So this is purely the advertising of McDonald's and this whole campaign that they're exciting people like my little brother, you know? And it sucks.
Well, let's turn the steering wheel a little bit to something equally negative and sad.
Oh, wow.
Jack,
sorry.
Was that you? Did you fart? Was that an audio fart?
That's a digital.
By the way, I'm very proud of myself. I ran 6 miles yesterday in the snow and 6 miles this morning. And actually, I'm a little worried about this. In fact, if any of our listeners out there can explain this, I ran with no gloves yesterday, and my thumb is still a little numb. And I don't understand that. I mean, I feel like I almost lost my thumb or that there's some dead tissue in there. So if anyone can help.
You'll have to call Dave Arnold.
Yes, I'll call Dave Arnold. I'm like, there's meat in there. It's food. Help me. Dave Arnold is the host of Cooking Issues, our number one rated show on the network. But speaking of health and me running all these miles, Jack forwarded me a very interesting article that basically implies that Steve Jobs, you know, he was a real hero. I was very sad when he died. He basically went against doctor's orders with his eating habits. It's something I want to ask Terrence about. You write, since he was a teenager, Job had practiced strange routines involving fasting and would go on obsessive diets. And that's a problem because the stomach needs enzymes to digest food and absorb nutrients, making it harder for patients who've had pancreas surgery to get enough protein. The standard of care is to have frequent meals and a diet with a variety of proteins from meats, fish, and milk. But as Isaacson pointed out, I guess he's the guy who wrote the article, Jobs has never done this, and he never would. So it's a real interesting thing. I'm always worried about my diet because I go out a lot for my work, Heritage Foods. We sell to all these restaurants. I'm constantly going out, eating, drinking too much. But, you know, I counter that with trying to run a lot. But it is a real interesting thing. I mean, diet can kill you even if you think you're doing the right thing.
Yeah, it's never a good idea to ignore doctor's orders.
Yeah, and it's also a real interesting thing. Sometimes trying to help hurts. Like we had Temple Grandin on, the mythical, you know, slaughterhouse lady. And she was like, you know, there were all these environmental groups that wanted to save horses. So with the desire to do something good, like helping horses, one of the things they did is they eliminated all horse slaughterhouses from the United States, thinking by eliminating the slaughterhouses, you were helping horses. You were discouraging people from eating horse meat. What's happened as a result of that PETA action? Horses are suffering left and right on fields across the entire America, you know, so something intended to do good, intended to, you know, buck a corporate system can actually sometimes, you know, be bad. That was a kind of random connection. But I guess that's it. That's our introduction. We can review. Have I missed anything, Jack? Any other famous people? Matthew McConaughey, he was on, what, 3 weeks ago?
I think so, yeah. Who knows? He may call in today and the morning after.
What's the show? Was it a good week, Jack, for radio?
Yeah. Every week's a good week, but this was also a good week. You know, it's kind of sad. There was a lot of good enthusiasm going towards this Occupy Big Food thing, and the snow really kind of stopped some people from coming. But, you know, I'm glad that the people that did show up showed up.
Well, it cannot be denied. And Nicole Taylor, by the way, was down south for the Southern Foodways Alliance Conference.
Right, yeah.
And she was like, everybody knows HRN. And I should say, Jack, you finally figured out how to judge our iTunes listenership.
Yes, that's right.
And we have like 500,000 to 600,000 people a month logging on to this station.
Well,
so
let me correct you. Our best show, Cooking Issues, had about 5,000 listeners for one episode.
Yeah, one episode.
Which really took me back because that's better than I thought we were doing. So I'm pretty happy.
It's good that you have high expectations. Well,
I did start paying people to listen, so.
Yes. Well, my mom's doing her job. She now has 5,000 email addresses on Hotmail. So, well, we're going to take a break and we're going to come back with the second greatest cheesemonger in the world, Terrence Brennan.
On behalf of everybody at HeritageRadioNetwork.com, we'd like to send a special thank you to the Hearst Ranch, our biggest supporter and longest-running sponsor since we first started in 2009. Hearst Ranch is the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. Since 1865, the Hearst family has raised cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of the Central California coast. The result is beef with extraordinary flavor that's as memorable and natural as the surrounding landscape. For more information, visit www.hearstranch.com.
Someday to find you're caught up in a
Now everyone's talking. I love it. Week in Review is over. This has turned into Terrence Brennan's living room. I love it. He's pouring tea. Terrence Brennan is the chef proprietor of the successful and acclaimed restaurants Picholine and Artisanal Fromagerie Bistro and Wine Bar. Well, it is an honor to have you. I mean, just for to contextualize for all you young people out there who are like, cheese, cheese is cool, and you participate in this whole artisanal cheese movement. They were probably two or three people, you know, who were like dinosaurs. They were there, you know, a full 10, 20 years before anyone else. And Terrence was one of them. And in fact, didn't Picholine kind of introduce the cheese cart?
Well, we certainly popularized it and made the cheese course, I think, a must for any restaurant worth their curd.
Uh-huh, nice.
And we built the first cheese cave in a restaurant to affinage the cheese.
Well, way to go. That's pretty awesome. So, I got to ask you about a couple of things just to connect this to the Week in Review. I mean, the Occupy Wall Street thing is tough because you have kids, right? You have two kids?
Absolutely. I have three children.
Three children.
Yes.
How old are they?
They're 18, 17, and 13.
So, I mean, they must kind of be like, hey, this Occupy Wall Street thing, like it must connect them to the Berkeley movement and all that. And yet, your customer base, as is mine, I mean, my mail order customer base and the people at the shop, I mean, rely on that 1%. So
how
do you ride that
we
line?
We have to be careful here.
Yes.
No, I applaud their efforts and, you know, the right of free speech and to right to assemble and all that. That's the American way. The system, I think, is somewhat broken and it's bringing up some very good issues to talk about and even politicians to address. So it's a good thing.
Yeah. And what about just to tie in the whole beginning before we get into the formal interview? I mean, diet, that was a real interesting thing. I mean, Steve Jobs, here's a guy who's a genius.
Right.
He has access to all the best medicine, all the best information, and he might have eaten himself to death, you know, in a weird way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what's your take on diet? I mean, also because your restaurants obviously feed a lot of people every day. So,
well, I think it always gets back to, you know, balance and proper nutrition and, you know, protein. It can be looked at as part of a healthy diet or not, but certainly a balance. I try to eat healthy as possible. Owning a restaurant, it's a double-edged sword because you have everything at your disposal, but yet you also have the vices at your disposal as well.
And yeah. Can you eat healthy going out to restaurants six nights a week?
Absolutely, you can.
Because there's more oils and salts and all that kind of stuff to give it the taste, right?
Right. Well, at my restaurants, we have vegetarian menus, and we're seeing that really become more and more popular. We even have a printed menu, a separate menu, and people are, even at Picholine, a fine dining restaurant, they're actually coming in because we have that, and we can accommodate vegetarians in a haute cuisine fashion.
Now, I like that Picholine is a restaurant that will have a vegetarian menu, but it doesn't call itself a vegetarian restaurant. Like, is vegetarian restaurants, is that even a cuisine? I mean, what does that mean? Like,
it is. I mean, vegetables are great. It's the next, it has been kind of growing in popularity as far as, I foresee, a fine dining chef doing a vegetarian restaurant very soon.
Mm-hmm.
So it's certainly here to stay. It's popular, and it is a healthy way to eat.
So take me through these early years of, Picholine to start. It's right smack dab in the middle of Lincoln Center zone, years before there were really any other restaurants in that zone. I mean, there was O'Neill's and there was a Ginger Man where the girls roll around in roller skates, all these kind of old school places, but there was really no fine dining at all on the Upper West Side. And to this date, it's still kind of lacking, even though there's some good restaurants.
Yep.
So take us through those early years. Like, what made you think Lincoln Center? How did you open that restaurant? What was its mission?
When I was looking for a space, I happened to come upon you know, it came through me through a, you know, the normal way through a broker. And then I met the owner, my current partner now, Marvin Numeroff, who had the space with someone else. And then
was it a restaurant at the time?
It was a restaurant.
Okay.
It was a restaurant. And we started chatting. We hit it off. We hit it off very well. And so, make a long story short, we became partners and then kind of redid the restaurant and opened it as Picholine.
And what was its mission? I mean, cheese?
It wasn't its mission. We opened up as a local bistro in the very beginning.
Okay.
And we're 20 years old. We're coming up on our 20th anniversary.
Wow.
And it was at the end of the 89, 90, 91 recession. So it was going to be a local bistro. And then I'm always one to always tinker and get up and try and do a better job every day. And it just morphed into, at one point, 5 or 6 years later, oh, the hell with it. We're just going to make it a fine dining restaurant because I'm just about there anyway. So it really was a progression of starting at a local bistro and then progressing into more and more fine dining and then, into what it is today.
Yeah, and then tell us about this historic cheese cart. I mean,
right.
I know you put right. you other people had done it. You were very modest about it, but I mean, you kind of put it on the map for real.
Right. When I was working, living, and training in France, cheese is a big part of their culture, as you know, and that was always part of their meals, whether it's family meal in a restaurant I was working at or going to a family's home on the weekend. Cheese was always part of a meal.
Mm-hmm.
So I developed a passion when I was there for artisanal cheeses, good cheeses. And some people say it developed into an obsession. So when I got back, I really wanted to do something with cheese. And fine dining restaurants in France have a cheese cart, the classic way of serving cheese. In at least France and some other countries, some serve it before as a beginner or starter. But in France, they serve it as a course, after main course and before dessert. So it's an actual course itself.
Who serves it earlier in the meal?
Well, you can do the charcuterie and cheese boards. Some Italian Spaniards right. kind of eat cheese and meats beforehand, et cetera. So that we wanted to introduce that, and then it just became people got excited about it.
What cheeses were you putting on 20 years ago?
Oh, my goodness. I was doing the cheese
Maytag?
Cart myself. No. What was I? I can't even. I started off, I think, with 10 cheeses, and I was doing it
American
myself.
American or?
No, it was around the world.
Around
we had a few
world.
American cheeses.
Who were the early Americans?
Oh, goodness. Who were? Mountain Shepherd from Vermont.
Right. That's still.
That's still a standard bear. I mean, still a great American cheese.
But you were mainly this was the era of France.
Absolutely. And then as we developed the program, and I call it a program, not just having a cheese plate on a dessert list, the typical thing was they'd pull it out of a cold box and slice it and serve you cheese, is we really wanted to serve it in the proper way and give its pay homage to fromage and its glory.
Describe what that means, proper way.
Well, buying artisanal cheeses, buying high-quality cheeses, keeping them in the right temperature, keeping them in the right environment. We like to say we develop a spa for them where we turn them, we massage them, etc. Serving at room temperature, having an educated staff to serve the cheeses. And then we built the cheese cave, which we were able to really keep them at the optimum temperature and humidity.
How was that with the health department and all that?
Well, back then it wasn't an issue whatsoever. Now it is. Now they want everything at 42.
So have you had to change? Or?
Well, we did at...
they're not listening.
We're affinaging somewhere else, but I can't do it so much in the restaurant. I have to have that at 42 degrees. But we affinage from another site.
Hmm. Very interesting. And so was it received immediately? I mean, did people know 20 years ago to ask for that cheese cart to get rolled in?
Well, what had happened is we started getting a lot of press about it.
Okay.
And then,
who was that? Florence Fabric Camp? People
yeah,
like that?
Yeah, everywhere. It became a real destination for cheese, and it was people just came because of that, and it was a big part of our business. We sold a lot of cheese, and then it turned in such a program where we Max McCallman, I worked with him, and then he eventually took over the program because it got to be too big for me to deal with myself, and I had to run the restaurant, be the chef, etc. So it kind of grew into this into this monster. And then he ended up getting an assistant and another assistant. And it just really was quite amazing to see this whole thing bloom and develop into, you know, into the beginning, I think, of the what we call the cheese. I don't know. Help me out here, Patty. The cheese renaissance,
for sure. But tell me though, back in the day, I mean, was it? How did you learn it? I mean, were you just? Was this an idea you had, and then you went back to learn it?
You know, it really got back
was
to
it
just
conceptual or
following a passion. So I started with that, and then I did research and tasted cheeses, and started with 10 cheeses that turned into 16. Talked to some more cheese producers, tasted that, got interested. One thing led to another, built the cheese cave, and then when we opened the bistro in 2001, we actually built five different cheese caves with different temperature and humidity to really truly affinage each type of cheese. And then I went back to France and worked in Philippe Alliot in Paris and a couple other cheesemongers in Burgundy and really learned the art of affinage.
So was this something you learned after the idea came? I mean, in a way.
Yes. Like, I just wanted to serve great cheese. It started out at Picheline serving great cheese. That turned into wanting to learn more and find and seek out different producers of cheese. Then when we really started thinking about affinage, that's a whole different
I want to ask you about affinage. Yes. There was a big article.
It was.
Times. I'm going to ask you about that. And by the way, let's talk about that because Steve Jenkins was railing against it.
Yes.
You've got to give him props because you and him were early pioneers.
You know,
right?
I can go back with Steve way back in the beginning when he actually, I invited him to give our first staff seminar at Picheline.
How many
F-bombs?
Know
Steve, right?
Did
he's a little wacky, right? Yeah. So it was a little unfocused, and I said, okay, thank you so much, Steve. It was surprising for him to say that because absolutely, affinage works, and it's part of, I mean, it's the aging process of cheese. I mean, it's the way it works, you know. Mm-hmm. It's so I was really shocked just to read him saying that affinage is a crock, I think he said, or something. I don't know.
Well, that's probably not what he used because when I very first started slow food in the United States, I did not know anything. This was back in the, 2000. And Steve Jenkins ran our first seminar. And by the way, there's about to be cursing in here, but I'm just quoting. So if you're a teenager, turn off your radio. But he starts off, and I'm just like, oh, there are all these people from Sever. At the time, Sever was a very powerful magazine. It doesn't seem to be so powerful now. And anyway, back then, it was the magazine. So the entire Sever staff was there, and all these members, these early pioneering members. And Steve Jenkins starts basically the first seminar of all time for Slow Food USA in the United States. He's like, we can all thank the fucking Germans for fucking co-opting the cheeses. And I'm like, I'm ruined. I've been back in New York for 2 days and I'm ruined, you know. But he is an interesting guy, though, and he's actually a very big sponsor of Heritage Foods, and he's a brilliant cheese pioneer. But let's talk about what we were talking about earlier. These Upper West Side is transformed, and you actually are friends with one of my closest family friends, Francesco Antonucci, which we once met. He had Remy, which was like a full block long. I mean, that place, I don't know how he ran it for so long. It was an Adam Tahani restaurant. But how have restaurants changed over, or how has the New York restaurant scene changed over 20 years?
Mm. Well, it's gotten much more competitive. There are a lot more restaurants that have better food in them, a lot more choice. The ingredients are better than ever. For me, it's all about the ingredients, and then with all these new cooking technologies. I was sitting with my chef's at Picheline, and we were discussing, in theory, and new dishes and my thought processes and working on new dishes and tasting menus and stuff. And I was just, they're younger, they're in their 30s, and I was just commenting on what a fantastic time it is to be cooking.
Why?
Now versus, 20 years ago.
Why?
Because of all the access of all these great ingredients, because of the the cooking technology we have, you know, the sous vide is just a fantastic technique that really you know that really helps with the quality of cooking, and then and then the other chemical stuff. We play a little bit with that, but it's a freedom now, especially with the El Bulli's and with the 30-course tasting menu and stuff, where it's okay just to serve. You don't have to have protein, meat, and vegetable on every plate. You can just do something very exciting and just one or two ingredients, and it's about the product.
It's about the product. Yeah, no, that has changed. I mean, in the 70s and 80s, it was all those French guys. Now, all of a sudden, like, even random little holes in the wall are producing delicious sandwiches. And anyway, on that note, we'll take a break, and we'll come back for a final segment with Terrence, and then we're going to have Aaron Fairbanks, the organizer of Goat-tober. We're back. It is Sunday. It's the main course. We're broadcasting out of Roberta's, 261 Moore Street. We are sponsored by Hearst Ranch and engineered and produced by Jack Inslee, who is the co-host of The Week in Review. Jack, no talking. The Week in Review is over. So we are here with the historical, the mythical. Sometimes I think young people don't know the roots as much. They like an idea, but they don't study it. They don't work as hard to become an expert. Well, if you do become an expert on cheese, you will know that Terrence Brennan is one of the pillars of the artisanal cheese movement here in the United States. So let's talk about challenges. Mm-hmm. I mean, 20 years, with Picholine, and then artisanal is, almost like Remy, like just a massive place. And it's also one of the few restaurants that's both cheese shop and restaurant. Right. So just take us through a little bit artisanal before we get into the challenges of running each restaurant.
Sure. Artisanal Bistro was formed. I wanted to take cheese to the next level and thinking, what can I do? And then when Francis Pirard opened up the bistro and pastry shop together, I thought, aha, that's what I want to do, that with cheese. So I was inspired by that. And then I was looking for a couple years for a space where I could do a cheese shop right next to it or above it or below it or wherever. And then this space came about. And, Marvin and I walked in there and looked just like, wow, this space just spoke to us. So
it was a big space.
Yeah. And
32nd Street?
It's not too big. It's only 160 seats.
That's still, though. You could fit more than if you wanted. It's on 32nd right off Park
Avenue. We sell
a
lot of your turkeys there, don't we?
Yes, you do. You do. That's like one of our biggest orders for sure.
Okay. And then, so that's when I really said, how can I take cheese to the next level? And really, when I went to Alios in Paris, I studied his caves, and he had five different caves in temperature and humidity, for one for Bloomy, one for Blue, one for Goat, one for Wash Rhine, and one for the mountain cheeses. And we designed those caves after that system. And then we also built a pseudo cheese shop. It's a counter that we sell retail out of the restaurant, and then we have an extensive a cheese list where we do cheese plates, and we sell cheese retail, and we do our affinage as well.
Very interesting. So, I mean, fondue, you serve fondue there.
Oh, yes.
That is the most fun way of eating in the history of the world.
It is.
And when I grew up in the 70s in New York City, there were fondue restaurants everywhere. Like, my mom was always taking me to a fondue restaurant. Where did they all go? I mean, why doesn't it work for most people. I mean, it works for you, obviously.
I think we're you know, because our parents did it or something. I don't know. It's like you remember those olive green fondue pots? Not olive green, the avocado green.
Yellow.
I don't know, because we're about cheese. I was, you know, when I was thinking about fondue, and I went to Switzerland to study fondue, and but once you've seen pretty much, there's two fondues in Switzerland, you've pretty much seen them all.
So
but
what are they?
They have the traditional, you know, the mountain cheese fondue, two blend cheese.
And does that have to be a certain blend, or it can just be a certain content of fat or sweetness or something like that?
No, they use the Comté style cheese, and then they have the soft one, the very soft mountain cheese. Man, I didn't have coffee yet, Patrick, so you're going to have to excuse me.
I offered you a few drinks, but you turned them down.
Yeah, Patrick offered me a shot of what were you
offering? Fernet Branca.
Fernet Branca. That's easy. That
clean
goes down
your insides.
That goes down easy in the morning, right?
Yeah.
So
there is a specific type of fine. What's the other type?
And then that's about it. There's the... I'll think of it in a minute, but it's a very soft mountain cheese, and they literally melt it. They don't put wine in it. And they just warm it over, and then there's raclette, which they do the raclette over by the fire on the thing, and they scrape it off.
That has a specific machine to it, right? And you like melt it over potatoes, or
right?
Something?
They have a it's almost like if you think about a hamon brace, a holder. Mm-hmm. They put a half a wedge of cheese in there, and then they, you know, some restaurants will have a fireplace, and ideally you put it up, you know, let it melt along the fireplace, and then scrape it off on the potatoes and. It's excellent.
Very interesting. So which is the bigger money maker? Is it the few seats of Picholine, or is it the big bistro? I mean, because you're running one kind of boutique restaurant,
right?
Like an old institution. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not to say that artisanal isn't, because mm-hmm. I remember in the very early slow food days, Carlo Petrini and all that, we were all going to artisanal for, you know, massive cheese dinners where we would taste 100 cheeses.
Right.
But, I mean, which is more profitable for you and which is kind of more fun to run? Is it the old Grand Dam of your empire?
I'm kind of schizophrenic with it. I love fine dining and I love bistro. So that's why I have both of them. The overhead of fine dining is, you know, there's a lot of overhead, a lot of labor involved, and the cost of ingredients, et cetera. And it's not getting any easier. The bistro is, you know, we still buy the same quality ingredients as we do at Picholine. But perhaps instead of wild turbo, it's halibut. Or mm-hmm. If it's dry aged sirloin, it's hanger steak that's dry aged. So, but we use a lot of the same purveyors.
So funny, I would have thought hanger steak would have been more expensive, considering how little there is per animal. You know,
but right?
It's
right.
Funny that that's a lesser cut,
yes,
even though it's only 2 pounds per cow.
Right.
But well, listen. Now, I don't know. Obviously, none of our listeners can see Terrence, but he has been fed grapes by very scantily clad ladies. And there's three ladies. This is the first guy that comes with three ladies. So I've got a word for each one. I mean, I've got to say, who are you? What's your affiliation with Terrence? Are you his PR person or what? I'm going to go around the room. That, by the way, that whole grape thing was not true. They were prunes. Terrence is very old and he needs digestive help. No, just kidding. Go. I got to go around.
Work?
Yes, it does.
It does. I can hear myself. Wow, this is really cool.
Yeah. Have you had a good time so far?
Yeah. This is a fun little place you got going on. Yeah.
Have you enjoyed the interview so far?
I have.
Okay,
I have.
Good.
Yeah. So my name is Sharon Bridward and I work through the Artisanal Restaurant Group, and I'm working on actually a new division called the Catering Division, which we're going to be launching. So please go on our website and check out our, you know, offers.
What is that website?
It's artisanalbistro.com.
Fantastic. Artisanal Bistro, we will tag that on the show, so you don't
Wonderful.
Have to write that down. Just do a search.
What about the festival we're planning?
And yes. This is actually the official launch, Patrick.
Okay.
You're getting a hot item right now.
The New York Times is getting old.
Seriously. It's all about, Heritage Radio. We are actually putting together the first ever cheese festival in Manhattan.
Oh.
Yeah, this coming spring.
Really?
And it's going to be an exciting endeavor. And we're looking, you know, out there right now to all of our resources, and hopefully we can get you involved as well.
We'd love to be a part of a cheese thing. And listen, yeah. All my cheese decisions go through Anne. But if she's behind it, I'm behind it, because that sounds really good. So you're talking about like a serious event almost in the spirit of what Slow Food did in Italy, where they would get a lot of people to come to an event. All about...
It's going to be huge.
Yes.
Yeah.
All about different forms of milk.
Yeah, as well as pairings, as well as classes. So this is going to be a really big endeavor, and we're really excited about it.
And we can follow that on this network for sure, but also on your website.
On our website, yes. We will have stuff up and running soon and linking you on to an official website.
Okay, very, very good. And let's see.
Oh, I'm going to introduce myself. My name is Jody Lipton. I am Terrence Brennan's girlfriend, and met Terrence at Picheline.
Oh, very nice.
So the first time I was at Picheline was in 2001. It became my favorite restaurant at that time.
Okay.
And years later.
It still is.
It still is.
Okay,
and,
good.
And I went to Picheline, and that's where I met him. And one of the things I love about both of those restaurants is that you can explore different cheeses, and then you actually get a listing of the cheeses that have been served.
Hmm.
I have many of those brochures at home. So, yeah, great to be here. Thank you.
Very nice, very nice. And we have someone who helps bring Terrence's dreams into reality.
I'm Susan Numeroff, and I'm Terrence's partner. And we've been together 19 years. And... I'm sort of the little voice in the background, constantly.
Oh, man. And, well, very, very good. So
I have to give a shout-out to my chefs. They're going to really give me a hard time.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I had some coffee now. So Jonathan and...
Jamie.
Jonathan and Jamie. I do know your names, by the way. So I am... anyway, I have coffee now, and my brain is working.
Very, very good. Well, this has been a really unbelievable show. Jack, thank you so much for engineering it.
Yep.
Terrence and the ladies, thank you so much for coming in. And next week we have a final show, and then it's turkey season. So I need to be in Kansas City dividing out Terrence's and other people's turkeys. But thank you so much for listening. And Katie is doing a show. Straight, no chaser.
You
right
got
after
it.
This.
There you go.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. The following is a public service announcement from Food Karma. To kick off the New York City Meat Week in style, Meat with a Twist will bring together the best chefs and mixologists for a cocktail food pairing party on November 7th from 6 to 10 p.m. at City Winery. Meat with a Twist features 10 cocktails paired with 10 chef selections highlighting local, sustainably grown meats such as duck, lamb, chicken, pork, beef, bison, and ostrich. The party will launch a week's worth of events throughout the city that celebrate the slow food movement bringing sustainable meats to our tables. Again, that's November 7th from 6 to 10 p.m. at City Winery. Updates, tickets, and more information are available at meatweeknyc.com.